Please thank you all for coming today to hear our introduction to the education enterprise. Before we get going, I hope everyone would please turn off your cell phones, your Blackberries, your PDAs, your laptops, anything that receives a transmission because it will make our sound system buzz. Silencing it and vibrating it is not enough. You actually have to disconnect yourself from the rest of the world for this important presentation and turn it all the way off. We're pleased to be here today in joint session. Senator Hatch is the chair of the Senate Education Committee.
I'm ready to go.
All right. Obviously, this is the first meeting that some of us have. We will be adopting our rules for committees at our first official meeting. We're here today to hear a presentation that was recommended by the Education Design Team that was created in House Bill 3141. And I'd like to invite Representative Betty Comp, who nursed much of this into existence, to give a quick overview of what brings us here today and the history behind it.
Chair Gelser, can I sit here? Or do you want me to sit down below?
Your preference.
You're fine.
That's what I'm thinking.
Just go, girl.
Okay, thank you, because it just takes more time. Members, you have written testimony in front of you, and I'll just follow that. Madam Chair and colleagues, for the record, I am Representative Betty Comp, House District 22. I'm here to share a little background about the interim work on the Education Design Team, which was created part of House Bill 3141. In Section 15, Subsection 2, is the definition. The purpose of the design team is to design a new legislative process for review and decision-making regarding state agency budgets relating to pre-kindergarten to higher education. The process shall use a holistic or enterprise approach to the pre-kindergarten to higher education. Prior to the passage of House Bill 3141, which passed overwhelmingly in both chambers, Oregon already has had a strong voice advocating for and providing the best education possible for our students. After the startling report of a nation at risk in 1983, the Oregon legislature made history by enacting the 21st Century Act for our schools. It became what we call SIM and CAM, and we repealed the core of that legislation in 2007. Today, we face the challenge of a struggling global economy, world academic competition, a national recession, and an opportunity to be better leaders and decision makers in education. When the design team heard the following statistics, there was a strong sense of urgency to explore how we legislate. On average, a dropout in Oregon costs the state $8,460 more each year in social services, food stamps, the criminal justice system, and other costs than an individual contributes in state taxes, property taxes, and fees paid into the system. In addition to the obvious costs, this represents a huge loss in human potential. Studies on prevention among children ages birth to five estimate the reverse, that there is a 10 to 15% return on investments of early childhood education programs. This is one of the highest returns in the education continuum. In Oregon, more than 100,000 children lack mentoring relationships. Therefore, is it difficult for students to envision doing the crucial jobs that are lacking in our workforce? Our work began by setting the goal and embracing the vision that the governor has shared with us, that 40% of all entering students graduate from college with a bachelor's degree, 40% of entering students receive an associate's degree or equivalent skills, and the remaining 20% receive a high school diploma, the 40-40-20. Our work, recognizing that 10 legislative members had possibly 10 different outcomes for our work, we spent several meetings walking all over the map with the help of James Zager, the governor's senior policy advisor, who worked very closely with us and was a member of our team. We are here today to continue the discussion. He will be sharing documents and information that you will hear in a summary form. As newly sworn in members of the 75th legislation session, I hope that you'll take this opportunity to learn and ask budgetary questions. Mr. Zager has invited agency leaders to assist in our discussion. Our goal is, as a design team, was to have an informed, shared discussion with policy committee members and ways and means members on how to legislate in the most effective manner. Our education partners, the Board of Education, the Higher Board of Education, community colleges, and the Department of Education, teacher standards and practices, have the opportunity to collaborate, bring in community partners, discuss, debate, and suggest possible legislation to us all year long. But we only have 6 months every other year to lead and govern. Today, it is our opportunity to think of the future and begin a dialogue to reach the 40-40 vision for our state. I want to recognize and thank all the members who contributed to the design team, Representative Buckley, Representative Flores, Representative Jensen, Representative Nathanson, Senator Cruz, Schrader, Starr, and Walker. I also want to give a big thank you to Senator Devlin, not only for his leadership and shared vision, but for his ability to acknowledge the very important work of the education design team throughout the interim session. His continued support did not go unnoticed, and he was an integral part of our success. I want to close with a short story. When I was about 10 years old, I started teaching. My parents worked together literally morning, noon, and night to start a dairy farm. My older brother and sister went out to do the chores and assist in taking care of the animals. I am third oldest of 14 children, and it was my chore to take care of all my younger siblings. What I did was teach them to count out the silverware, plates and cups in order to set the table while I cooked, how to sing while we did the dishes, memorize the alphabet while ironing and folding clothes, and to take care of each other. But that was 50 years ago. Colleagues, the world has changed. I have changed. But my passion for every child to meet his or her own potential has not. It will take each and every one of us to look systematically, drilling down, debating, to find options and opportunities for all students ages 5 through 22. Let's begin. With that, one document that I brought, and I know James has several others, and I have that on the dais before you, is just a sample, literally a sample of one piece of information that we received about how we might look at life differently at the legislature. And as many of the documents that James and his team is bringing today, it's all just hopefully thought-provoking, and whether we make changes or not, that's up to us. But, and I don't know that we need changes, but it's like, how do we reach this goal? Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. And we're very fortunate to have a full complement of people for this discussion around the table, the members of the revenue committees of both chambers, the subcommittee members of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And I'd especially like to welcome our new co-chairs of Ways and Means, Senator Carter and Representative Buckley. So thank you all for coming. And with that, I turn it over to you. I hope that this becomes a lively conversation over the course of the next several hours as we work together to vision the future for our students of all ages.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, Chair Haas, and if you don't mind, I won't go through the list of all the chairs and co-chairs every time. I'm James Sager. I'm with the Governor's Office, and my colleague here,
Margie Lau, also with the Governor's Office.
Well, first, let me begin by thanking Representative Kopp, and as she thanked the members of the design team, I too want to thank them for recommending this hearing, and thank the legislative leadership for supporting that recommendation and making this happen today. Hopefully, this is the first of what will become a pattern in the future of being able to have moments in the legislative process where we can actually have maybe a broader conversation as opposed to simply looking at policies and budgets kind of in isolated ways. We have a PowerPoint presentation that you should have a packet of material, and so we will get started. First of all, let me highlight the agenda. We have tried to put this together in three pieces so that Margie and I will make a presentation of some material around the one of the three topic areas, and then we hope that we can open it up for a discussion question-answer period. Please work with us if we mention that, gee, that's a great question, and we're going to address it in detail in the next piece of the presentation, because we know we're already anticipating what the questions are you might ask. And excuse me as I try to look around each way to get the full spectrum here of the dais. We appreciate everyone being here. I also want to acknowledge and thank Superintendent Castile, Commissioner Preuss, and Chancellor Pernsteiner, and Dennis Johnson from the Director of OSAC, who are behind me here. They and their staff have just done remarkable work over the past several years, not only working with our office, but the work that they've done for students in Oregon and for the future of the state of Oregon. And while they're not sitting right here at the table with Margie and I today as part of the official presentation during the question and answer period, by all means, if we have kind of a deer in the headlight look, we will turn to our colleagues behind us who can feel free to come up and help address those questions and concerns. The first section we'd like to walk you through is the a document that we put together, again, collectively. Every time I'll mention this several times, but you have to think about this effort as really being a collaborative effort, that all the partners in the education enterprise have worked very well together to pull this, to not only pull this presentation, but to get the vision. So the mission of the enterprise is to ensure that Oregonians possess the knowledge and skills necessary to succeed in learning, work, and citizenship to create prosperity and opportunity for Oregon in the global economy. That is a mouthful, but at the same time, it is what education is all about. It is not just preparing a worker, it is preparing involved, dedicated citizenry. It is providing a quality of life, whether that is defined by your income or your involvement with nature or just how you felt when you woke up this morning. Education plays an important role in all of those elements. And so we have tried to capture that holistic view of the mission of education. We then, as you heard from Representative Comp, and as you, those of you that served in the last legislative session, included in a couple of pieces of legislation, the governor, along with many of you and the business community, have been advocating for several years now that for the state to be competitive in the global economy, for Oregonians to have a chance to gain that level of prosperity that we want, that we need to set a target for ourselves, a goal by the year 2025, to have 40% of Oregonians with a bachelor's degree or higher, 40% of Oregonians with an associate's degree or professional certification, the second 40, and the remaining 20% of Oregonians at least having a quality high school diploma. That is an ambitious goal, and when we begin part two of the presentation today, we will actually give you an update as to where we are, and then we can begin talking about how we might move towards those goals. Next, we have in the five diamonds, five outcomes. And if you read these outcomes, you'll notice that they are not sector specific. They are not outcomes that say, you know, the K-12 system will do X and the university system will do Y. And the reason for that is because, again, viewing this holistically, the idea is that each element, each sector, each classroom, each program contributes to the entire Oregon education system moving to meet those outcomes and thus the goals. And so that's why they are not highlighted by sector. And that's why, in part, why the layout of the diagram is the way it is, so that we're not, again, making it look like a particular sector goes to a diamond, goes to a circle, but it is the holistic view. And we've tried to identify in those outcomes, again, the complete gamut. They're well prepared, both for employment and citizenry. They're successful. They're making successful progress in the learning environment that they're in. There is access and affordability to a quality program, again, throughout the system. that workers have the training and education necessary to help Oregon businesses succeed, and that the enterprise provides further benefits to the economy and community, in addition to the fact that they are a major employer in many of our communities. They contribute, again, kind of to the well-being of the entire community.
We've also been working extensively with all of the education agencies to focus on universal indicators, to develop measures that everyone has a partial ownership to the overall accomplishment of that particular indicator that helps us know how close we are in terms of our ability to achieve the outcomes that are in the diamonds. And this is an area where we really ask for your support and to work closely with us, because one of the things that we get as feedback from the agencies are that sometimes the expectations that come from various legislative entities is one to have to achieve a lot of different indicators. Sometimes those indicators don't coordinate well with the indicators with their partners in education, either before or after their portion of the delivery of that education to Oregonians. And so we would ask, as you look at these questions and work with our agencies during this legislative session and during the interim, that you think about this again in a very holistic fashion, that the education that's being provided by a particular entity, that usually that is not the end, but usually a midpoint in the learning process for that particular student, and to make sure that that is going to articulate well with that's occurred before and that which will occur afterwards. These give you some examples of measures, and we've tried to make them as agency non-specific as possible, and also to give you examples of those that are key indicators that relate to the diamond immediately above them. But this is clearly still a work in progress, and as you consider these budgets and presentations that come from the agencies, we urge you to think about them not just as it relates to that particular agency in the discussion, but as it relates to those you'll hear after them as well. We don't have it in this slide, but it will be at the latter portion of our presentation where we'll get into the discussion about the inputs. That's really the resources and the policies that are the drivers behind how we achieve these goals. And we'll be talking about how the governor's recommended budget helps support that effort. We've given you here a list of all of the agencies that are directly involved with the achievement of the education enterprise. But we also acknowledge that there are also some key agencies who are in the immediate vicinity. For example, the Employment Department, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Office of Economic Development and Community Services all play key roles in terms of being recipients of a capable, educated workforce, or being people who help funnel people back into the training system so that they are even better prepared. And so we have these little arrows that show the contribution across from everyone as we achieve these goals.
So we are at the first juncture where, while you don't have this slide in your packet, you do have this slide in your packet. We will only begin with, we're transitioning here. The slide that you have in your packet has some additional material at the bottom, if you'll notice, and let's not talk about that yet. That'll be our segue into the second part. And what we'd like to do is now open it up for comments, discussion, ideas about that first one-pager that we just walked you through to get your feedback on. Have we captured the vision, the mission? Is it appropriate? What else should we think about?
Madam Chair, there's a question.
Yes, Representative Van Orman.
Madam Chair, I have a question about under workers having training education necessary. And one of the indicators are percent of small businesses, clients who have startup, and then that they survive 3 years. And those two pieces, for me, have not always necessarily been part of the educational system. So I'm curious, what does that mean in terms of education?
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, this is an example of a measure that exists in the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
Thank you.
And it's a way in which they gauge the success of their business and technical education functions that often are one of the centers in many community college
okay.
campuses.
Thank you. I forgot that part.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We've always had this sort of basic discussion. I just wanted to get this on the table. The 2040. Obviously, you'll give us some information soon about where we are in regards to those numbers. They're relatively lofty numbers at almost all levels. We usually start out with the discussion that there is a judgment in here somehow that 100% of Oregon students will at least achieve a high school diploma. Some of us will tell you that that may be beyond reality depending upon what the qualifications are for that diploma. That does not mean that the person is not going to be a productive citizen. It might mean that they actually get other types of training and they get some kind of equivalency in terms of a diploma, but to say that you're going to have 100%, the cost of getting that last 5% might exceed the cost of some of the other areas that you have and may not be achievable. And then you get into the very basic question. If you were to look at that 20-40-40, probably the area we lack the most in is the middle 40 in terms of the associate degree or training in terms of workforce development and the cost thereof. And then the other basic question that we always ask, are these numbers for individual Oregonian students, or are we going to take into consideration what we do in terms of the number of Oregonians that actually move here? We obviously have a much higher rate in terms of individuals with bachelor's degrees and above than we actually graduate from within the state. If I say one assumption and I say I'm going to take that into consideration, your 40% seems achievable. If I don't take that into consideration, the what it would take to get to that level is much more significant. So I think those are some of the basic questions that I think people will start to ask as they get into this deeper and deeper. And one of the other basic questions is, I don't think any of us are advocating greater control, and I'll be a little bit more blunt than I should be, but I think within this building there are parties that really have some issues with the fact that they hand out in the state of the state school fund over $6 billion. State of in community college is about $500 million. Obviously, we have pretty direct control on the university system, but we do not have much direct control on those expenditures after they get outside the building. And while the superintendent of public instruction has some control, she doesn't have that much, nor does, obviously, the commissioner of community colleges. But I think the other side of that is, how do we start to think of that as a advantage rather than a disadvantage? Because it's not like that we've got a great history with large monolithic organizations actually being on the vanguard of efficiency. You only have to look as far as General Motors to find that isn't the case. So I think those are some of the questions I'd like to put on the table.
Chair Yeltsin, if I might just respond to Senator Devlin's question. Many of the questions that you brought up, sir, we will be addressing as we go through the presentation today. I do want to make one clarifying point, and now I realize that the wonderful first-page document that we've worked on so long is missing a key component, and that is the 40-40-20 goal is for Oregonians by age 25. And the reason for that, and again, we'll get into some more detail about this in a minute, is to really, again, trying to look holistically at the way Oregon students and people who migrate into the state of Oregon, how they interact with our education system. So we'll get into some more details, but when you step back and you think about it as by that age, then it kind of gives you a different different sense of how you might work it out.
Thank you. Are there other questions? It's a very large dais, so if I miss you, wave largely. Okay, go on.
Well, excellent. As I promised, we would start addressing the question of where we are today. As you can see, this data comes from work that has been done for us and pulls out census data. And if you look at it, as of the year 2007, we had 11% of Oregonians that did not have a high school diploma. We have 26% of Oregonians that do have a high school diploma, but in their feedback didn't indicate that they had anything beyond that. Then we get to what we would consider the middle 40%. We know that 18% of Oregonians tell us that they hold an AA degree or professional certificate, and another 15% say they have some college, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And we know that for the bachelor, associates, or BS and BA and higher, we're running at about 30%. So it gives you a perspective that, number one, it is a goal that is going to stretch our thinking and require us to really focus some resources, but at the same time, it's a goal that is not necessarily insurmountable. Now, a lot of the work that has been done by the work groups and the different commissions that we've had operating can look at this and say, you know, there may be some low-hanging fruit here. We have 15% of Oregonians that have some college. A lot of the data shows that if, in fact, we get people connected to a post-secondary system, that they then pursue a degree or certificate. The other question that we have challenged is, so they have some training. Maybe they even have a certificate or an AA, but does it match? Do their skill sets match up with what the Oregon business community needs? And so a lot of work is being done trying to make that connection. The 11% that don't have the high school diploma gets directly to your question, Senator Devlin. If we look at Oregon students, between the time they either complete high school or they drop out and they don't complete at age 18, kind of the traditional point, they go through all sorts of pathways to get to either a high school diploma, a GED, or enter directly into a community college and may earn their AA degree and go on to get their bachelor's in advance because of the way the system in Oregon operates. Our community colleges don't require a high school diploma. They take entrance exams, and so they move. So again, looking at this, the system is really adapting to meet the various needs of Oregon students, and Oregon students find those pathways before age 25. What is interesting is that, the census data indicates that the in-migration pattern, we bring in as many advanced degree future Oregonians as we do individuals that do not have a high school diploma. So what it has raised for us is the question that while we absolutely must continue to work on improving the quality of the diploma in Oregon and helping more and more students complete, we have a great need in the adult population that we have to find even better ways to bring them back into the education system, and that is almost exclusively through the community colleges and then into the universities. So it begins to give you, again, a different picture, moving away from that kind of traditional pipeline thinking.
where, quite honestly, the students that exit 12th grade every year in Oregon have really very little impact on the economy of Oregon and the workforce of Oregon. But what is of even greater or equal importance, let me put it that way, are the adult Oregonians out there that need this additional training and assistance.
Mr. Sager, I think Representative Roblin has a question.
I just want a clarification on, you know, this says 2007, those are the numbers.
Yes.
Now, is that 25-year-olds, or they received their degree by 25? Is it the same statement that you made earlier? So these are 25-year-olds right now, or is this all Oregonian?
Chair Yeltsin, Representative Roblin, we're trying to break it down at 25. This does include total population, but we're trying to do the work to be able to break this down even further. This is kind of where we are at this point in time.
So this is all Oregonians,
yes,
over 25, basically?
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to the goal, but we're trying to get that by 25. They were. Correct. Okay. Just one minute. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. I think with that, we're going to, I have to remember what our slides are. The next series of slides, we've also been working with the national data to give you a perspective of where we are compared to the other states. And as this chart shows, we've looked, and this is again based on 2006 data, so a lot of the data takes us 2-3 years before the national data is put together in a format. So this is 2006 data. But this is looking at the number of Oregon high school students, or number of high school students, who directly enter the next fall into a post-secondary education institution. Oregon is pretty low on this chart. The question then comes, why? What is it that is interfering with that transition? This is another topic that we're spending a lot of time trying to analyze. For instance, if you remember, prior to 2006, our financial aid program for students going into community colleges and universities was pretty meager. Maybe a major hurdle for our students to immediately enter post-secondary system was financial. There may be a cultural issue here in Oregon. That is some of the kind of anecdotal feedback we've been getting from people, where they want to take a year off. They want to travel. They want to find themselves. They want to figure out what they want to do before they enter a post-secondary institution. So we're trying to find out what all the key components are for making those decisions. And another one, and we've talked about this a lot, do they not feel prepared? And so, again, that ties in with the work that we'll be doing to align, or we have been doing to align the system. The next slide, then we kind of continue into...
Mr. Sager?
Oh, I'm sorry.
A question from Senator Hatch.
I don't mean to offend anybody from the South, but I have to ask, is that really Mississippi at the head of the pack on that slide that was there?
Exactly.
It is. It's a reversal.
Madam Chair, I am definitely waiting to give Mr. Sager a lot of questions on that same issue, that we always put Mississippi down, and here Mississippi leading the pack, the southern region, is leading the pack, and we have taken so much pride over the years to talk about, that's worse than Mississippi. Even I do that.
I know the graduation rates, Madam Chairs.
Yes.
It's because Mississippi has such a low graduation rate that the people that are actually graduating, a higher percentage of them are going on to college.
They just flunk them out of high school.
I think we just timed out the computer.
Representative Combs, not to disagree with my honorable senator, but they also have done some major education reforms in the past 10 years.
Right, right. They've improved significantly.
Yes.
Do you have a definitive answer on?
Well, Chair Yeltsin, the conversation was starting along exactly the right lines. This is looking at students who graduated from high school. Therefore, they have earned a diploma. Therefore, they have moved on. This is not the number of 18-year-olds who then enter a post-secondary system. So if, in fact, a state, unnamed, were to have a low graduation rate, they may have a much higher rate of those graduates immediately entering into a post-secondary system. whereas a state that has a higher graduation rate may have lower. So, you know, with what we're showing you here are some pieces of data, but it raises the question that we always have to question the data, and we have to understand what the indicators are behind. So,
and in fact, we didn't include a slide because it included data that was a couple years old that looked at how Oregon stacked up against the best in the nation, as well as the average in the nation on high school graduation rates, as well as all these other measures. And Oregon, in fact, exceeds the national average for high school graduation rates, which may attribute to, you know, us having a smaller percentage in this particular measure.
But it does. I'm hoping that your researchers show something in terms of motivation, because it does see something. I don't care if Mississippi does have a higher dropout rate and those not completing, but what is it that measures the difference between those that do graduate and go on to college, and we have a higher incidence, a dropout rate, but not the motivation to go on to college? I mean, that still is a lesson to be learned there.
Mm-hmm. Chair Yeltsin, Senator Carter, you're absolutely right. And that is, like I say, the kind of digging down into the data that we're trying to work on to figure out what are all the indicators. And we'll go into a little more detail when we talk about some of the different work groups and commissions that are operating and how they're working on this. But today we're just trying to give you a flavor of what we've been looking at and working on, and why that leads then to the third section, which is some of the suggestions we have for moving forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Roblin and then Representative Dembro.
I guess what I would say is I'm really excited that Mississippi is doing as well, and we need to continue to work to get better. The other data is nice to look at, but the reality is a large percentage of those people who are graduating are going, and even if we have more graduating, we should be getting them to college. So I'm proud of Mississippi and where they've gone, and I hope that we get better.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, have there been studies looking at the number of people who have been out for more than 1 year? That is, those who come back within, you know, after between 1 year and 3 years or something like that? Because, you know, I agree, in my experience, a lot of people choose to stay away for a year. But then those that come back stay back, whereas often those who stay away for more than a year don't come back for quite a while. So do we know how many people come back within 2 to 5 years?
Chair Yeltsin, Representative Dembro, what we know, and Marjorie, please chime in here, what we do know is that there is a greater likelihood of successful completion if a person doesn't step out for a period of time. In other words, they continue from high school into an institution. But again, that's looking nationally. And what we're trying to do is figure out, so what have been the impediments or the decision-making process that Oregon students have gone through, and therefore, is there a difference in that data? Because we do seem to kind of catch up by the time they're 25. Margie?
Well, and also, if you look at what's going on in some other states, and particularly with a lot of the private higher education institutions, they're now encouraging students to apply for application straight out of high school, but then granting them a year leave prior to their starting. So that way the student still has a connection, affiliation that then hopefully encourages them and pulls them back into the system rather than loses them.
Thank you. And Senator Devlin had a
comment. I just did want to get one other comment on the record, since Senator Farioli is not here and he would be making this comment. One of the things that we do see when you look deeper into the statistics is we have many good school systems in Eastern Oregon, many of them with fairly good graduation rates, but we do not have the same level of those students going on to college, and I think that's one thing we need to recognize. Yep. And it's an issue of access, and it's an issue of opportunity. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Monroe.
Thank you, Chair Gessler. I wonder, do you keep the numbers on which students actually completed all of their education here in Oregon, in other words, started in the first kindergarten and went on through, compared to people that moved into Oregon sometime before they were 25? and may or may not have received a portion of their education in Oregon.
Go ahead.
We're in the process of building a database that connects all the information for students from the point in which they start their education in pre-kindergarten or kindergarten, and that would track them through all the way to bachelor's degree and beyond. We're challenged in doing that by trying to identify the entries and exits of students from that system and determining the best way in which to measure the success of systems as well as segments of students when we have that very mobile population. But it's a very important piece, and we spent the last 4 years, and we'll continue to work on that for probably the next 10 years beyond. So
I think that's a very, very important number because you know, the 11% that are 25-year-olds that don't have the high school equivalency yet, you know, did the majority of them come through our school system, or are a majority of them, you know, recent entrance into Oregon for whatever reason?
Are there any other questions? Oh. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Don't want to overthink these stats, but just one thing stuck out in my mind. I'm wondering if there was any assumptions that you made on it. In the quote, lowest first six states with graduates moving on are all far west states. And maybe that's just an anomaly, or does that tell, is it something about access? There's a lot more colleges in the east. People are more aware of college. Is it, say, what is that, if anything, you read in the fact that it's all concentrated in the lower end, all out here in the Pacific?
Chair Gelser, Senator Metzger, that's another good question that we've been asking. Which kind of brings up the question, is there a West Coast culture that views immediate entrance differently and a different pattern? Here in Oregon, as Senator Devlin indicated a moment ago, we have had a trend where each successive generation is actually less educated than its parents. Why exactly is that? Could it be access and affordability? Could it be lack of seeing the connection between education and their future? Ironically, again, kind of anecdotal comments we've received from a number of our small rural communities is they hate to see their children leave and go to the university or even community college because they view that their children won't come back to the community, that there isn't an economic base there to have that degree or that training connected. So they want their children to stay, and they want their grandchildren to grow up in the community. That is why, as we go through the presentation today and as we talk through the session, you'll hear us constantly talk about how we are working so closely to connect education and workforce training with the economic needs of communities all over the state. This isn't a Portland Metro-driven discussion. We're actually able to drill down and look at every county, the communities, and try to make those connections to see how we can help lift up the economy, mm-hmm. get them the training that they need, and move forward.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am pleased to hear Senator Devlin speak of access because I live on the other side of the mountain and access is a critical problem for us. But I also grew up in Wisconsin. I went to a one-room school and so on and so forth. But it is a cultural thing as well. And I know that kids will come out of very small schools and they will go to the University of Wisconsin, which has 40,000 students, and not think anything of it. But they all are talking about going on to school. And there are schools in their University of Wisconsin, Platteville, you know, it's right there where we grew up. So I do think there is a cultural difference. I see it every time I go back. So I think we are dealing with cultural, but we're also dealing with access.
And we now have Representative Roblin and Senator Cruz in the queue. And after that, we're going to stop taking questions and let you finish your presentation until we get to the part on the agenda that says questions.
My only issue is that if a person goes directly from high school to the military, does that include? Do they count that as going on to school, or is that military separate? It is separate, because I will tell you that at least from some rural communities, that has been the exit place now for education and other things is military. And so there can sometimes be a disproportionate number of high school graduates from some of our rural areas that choose that as an option for people.
Yeah, Arnie and I have been teaming up over here. When we say going directly to college, is that just Oregon colleges or all colleges?
All colleges.
All colleges, okay.
Please continue. And unless there's something that can't wait, let's wait till the end of the presentation before there's more questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. So the next three slides, we look at our public two-year institutions. And the first one talks about retention, the retention rates. And once again, Oregon's at the low end of this continuum. But as one of the key issues that the new Post-Secondary Quality Ed Commission has been dealing with, the part of the problem with this analysis here is recognizing, A, what we mean by success. So a student oftentimes will go to a community college for a term, maybe two terms, maybe even a year, complete the amount of study he or she wants or needs, and not return the next year. That's success. But in the case of this retention number, it wouldn't appear that way. The other situation is that we have, and especially over the last several years, we have done a wonderful job, quite honestly, of aligning our community colleges with our universities, both through dual enrollment, dual credit, and we have all sorts of collaborations. This effort has been led extensively by President Ray at Oregon State University, and now all of our universities are involved with it, so that students move in and out of our institutions in a different pattern. It's not the traditional, you go to community college 2 years, you get your AA, you then move on to a university. So there, Oregon students are using online courses. They may be taking courses at Lane Community College and the University of Oregon and an online class from Eastern Oregon all at the same time. And so this data is also a little misleading. This is what comes out in the national reports, though, and it drives us to then ask ourselves what's behind it. So while it is low, and while we want to make sure that as we analyze this data, that in fact we haven't put impediments in the way of students to continue their education, we also can't look at this and say, gosh, this is a black mark on our community college system, because in fact students aren't using it any longer in the traditional method. The same is true then with the next two, where they look at the number of undergraduate awards provided, and then the next one certificates, because not only do we have the dual enrollment programs, as I mentioned, so students, again, move seamlessly to the university. But oftentimes, students will leave a community college having actually earned an associate's degree, maybe not even realize it, and move on to the university to complete their bachelor's. And so, statistically, it looks bad for Oregon. But in Oregon, we require students to ask for their AA degree and then pay a fee to get it, and oftentimes they don't do that. That might be an easy fix that we can address that would improve our data and actually be provide a better representation of the success that the programs have. The other certificates, again, as I mentioned, our community college system is absolutely vital in the education continuum for Oregon. And oftentimes, a large percentage of our students not only are part-time, but they are going for very specific training. They've been told by their employer, you can continue to be the bookkeeper here if you go to the community college and get these two classes. Or they're going to go in now with under the direction of our commissioner, we've done a lot more of the pathways work and this highly technical term of chunking programs into smaller pieces so that they aren't officially a degree or a certificate, but in fact they have completed a course of study and training that, when added to other pieces of training over the years, will add up to a certificate or degree, and the reason for that is to meet the needs of Oregonians who are working, trying to raise a family, and trying to move along this continuum. So a lot of work has gone on in understanding, again, what's behind these numbers, and part of it, as I said, may be as simple as bookkeeping on our part, but again, this is the kind of national data that's out there, and we didn't want you to be caught off guard when you see it in newspapers and magazines.
To then look at the four-year institutions, the public institutions in Oregon, in this instance, our numbers look almost at the national average level. And, you know, this may be a factor of those students who didn't feel that they were yet at the point in their life where they knew they needed post-secondary education and chose to step out. Once they do arrive on campus, they're more likely to stay on campus. So this may be one of those things where this is a statistic that we do better in because of those earlier decisions that students made about dating and preparation. And then when we look at the number of degrees that are awarded for students at Oregon's public four-year institution, Oregon is actually doing a bit better than the national average here. And this is an area where, you know, it's always good to have this kind of success, but if we don't have a high enough participation rate, then we're still not going to achieve that last 40% target that we have. And so we need to hang on to this graduation rate, but we need to have more students also choosing to enter our education system.
Is there another chart? If I might, before we go to the next little piece, another interesting statistic in Oregon is that half of our university students are students that have transferred from our community colleges. And they are graduating at the same rate and with the same quality of academic performance of those students who started at the university and went straight through. So not only does it reinforce that this data is a little misleading, but I emphasize that because it does also reinforce that integration that we have been working on now for the past several years to make sure that for students, it is seamless. What's the end result for students as opposed to what are the institutional requirements that are driving decisions? And that has really helped Oregon students be successful in this kind of almost transient education environment.
So in the bigger picture, look at all of this. We have been spending a great deal of time working with a new group that was created by executive order by the governor called the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission. Many of you are probably already familiar with the Quality Education Commission that studies the dynamics that occur within the K-12 educational system. And the what we call the PSQEC, is really now looking forward to saying, can we take some of the lessons learned about planning and big picture view of things in order to apply those same dynamics to our post-secondary education systems as well. And we've been working with some folks from a couple of national organizations. The National Council for Higher Education Management Systems has some folks who've already done some really great work in the states of Kentucky and Arizona, helping them study the dynamics that occur throughout their education systems. And so we're leveraging the work that's occurred in those states and figuring out the best way in which to apply those same principles here in Oregon in order to really address the hydraulics that occur throughout the system as we have hundreds of thousands of students and their families making decisions about their individual futures, but as they do that, it all accumulates into what's Oregon's future. And so to do that, we've collected data, and the model is under development right now, and we hope that it'll be pretty much ready for its pilot run by the end of this month, that collects the data from these key inputs and then looks at what the performance has been for these areas of throughput. So we're looking at population growth, those graduation rates from high school, college attendance rates, and then even participation from our adult workforce as well. And then their experiences once they enter the post-secondary system, that's what we refer to here as the throughput, to look at what our current statistics are and where we need to make changes so that we'll get the greatest improvement. And those states who are a couple of years ahead of us have done that and have discovered some things that were real aha moments for their states. The state of Kentucky really felt they needed to focus on their high school completion rate. You know, they have a lot of very poor sections in their state, and they felt that they could really change the economic situation for those families as well as the state by addressing that issue. And they thought they could do that and increase their graduation rates from college as a result. But they found that when they put a lot of effort into that, it didn't gain them the improvements that they expected. And that's where these systems that do the modeling can help us better understand the whole system dynamic. So, you know, this is the source of data, and as James had mentioned, this data is going to go into this model at the county level. So we'll be able to understand the challenges that occur in Mount Fair County as well as Multnomah County. And we'll be able to look at the dynamics that occur from students who are participating in every level of our education delivery system in Oregon to develop a better understanding of what's happening today, and if we apply certain changes, how much that change may be able to improve our attainment of that 40-40-20 goal.
Yes.
Hi, Representative Revlin.
Could, for some people, they don't know what Wichee is, except that it's a high school up here.
Wichee
High School, or is it? We had some people working because I thought it would be good for everybody to hear.
I thought that was in Coos County.
Exactly.
It's the Wichee Pirates.
The WHICHE stands for the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, and that includes representatives like Cam and George from Oregon and their counterparts across all of the western states, could then get together to share those statistics, and their staff that reside back in Boulder, Colorado, look at these data trends, and they wonder, those questions that have been posed here this afternoon, you know, why is it that the predominant number of the states at the tail end of these trends are western states? What does that mean, and what could we be doing collectively to improve that? So what we have here on this slide is actually the information that will be on what's called the dashboard for this model. And this is taking system-wide data for where Oregon stands today. And so you don't really see the changes that occur. And my apologies that on the printouts, the pale yellow squares don't really highlight. So the label there indicates that if it says goal, that's really what they're calling an active cell. That's an area where we can go in and change that percentage and then look to see if we make an improvement or if we lose ground in that particular measure, what impact does that have on the broader trends that will occur in the overall goal achievement. And that way, as we and you look at choices and proposals that come from the education community, we can ask for information about what the research indicates the change will be from those initiatives. And then we can plug that into these models and say, you know, what is the level of improvement that we'll be able to attain from that particular investment? And then we'll be able to use this as a way in which to also measure for accountability. Did the thing that had happened in the other place that had already started this proposal, were we able to successfully replicate that and achieve the outcomes that we'd hoped for here in Oregon? So we can use it as a monitoring tool.
We'd also wanted to take a moment to highlight what we're calling change agents. These are just a sampling of the key commissions and task forces and
teams of people that have been working over the past several years. As Margie mentioned, you're aware of the Quality Education Commission. They just released their new report. We've given you the websites on all these rather than running off 28 copies of everything. You can read it and print it yourself, I guess. But one of the areas of focus, for instance, in this year for the K-12 Commission was looking at the requirements of the new diploma. And so an addition to the report was a series of analyses that had been done about those elements that need to be added to the model to make sure that we give all Oregon students the opportunity to meet the new high school graduation requirements. The former superintendent of Canby, Deborah Summers, did a wonderful job of pulling together educators all across the state to have detailed conversations about what their school, what their system would need to do in order to give students this opportunity. It then moved forward and translated into not only a list of specific actions, but of course, as the K-12 model does, it rolls up the cost of providing those. And we'll highlight that during the budget conversation in the next section. The Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission, the new commission that Margie mentioned was set up by executive order, has put out its first report. I want to compliment the co-chairs, President Ed Ray from Oregon State University and President Mary Spielde from Lane Community College for taking on this effort. We've had a good group of commissioners working on this. We appointed Frank McNamara because he also serves on the K-12 Commission, and so that way we, from day one, began to make the connection to make sure that we, again, weren't looking at things in isolation. With the really the leadership of all the members of the commission, we've been making some major strides in being able to identify. You know, if you think about the K-12 system, it's pretty clear. We would hope that we get 100% of Oregon students to graduate on time with a diploma. Once you move into the post-secondary system, it's very hard to identify what the success point is, as I've mentioned before, and so we really have to look at it differently. And so rather than it being a model that simply says, here are the elements that we need, here's how much it will cost, this is what we need to invest, we're really trying to deal with all the variables that impact an adult Oregonian and how we can make the system more responsive and flexible to meet those various needs based upon whatever they determine their success is. And so it is a different approach. The Unified Education Enterprise Committee, marvelous group, it is one of the joint boards committees. Many of you will probably got a copy of their latest report. The work that they have done along with the faculty members at our community colleges and universities to align our curriculum, to align our assessment system, working with our high school across the state to align the value of the AP exam, to recognize what additional programs high school teachers can be trained on in order that they could teach it so that college credit can be provided these students. Just an amazing amount of work, and again, all aligned towards looking at the 40-40-20. And then I just highlighting here the Workforce Investment Board. We haven't mentioned them much, but the Oregon Workforce Investment Board has been a key partner in all of this because, again, everything we talk about, we're trying to be not just from my background being an educator saying, oh, you know, education is just good for the mind and soul. It also has to be good for the economy and the business community in the state of Oregon. And so they've been working, and so their strategic plan and the work they've done have also played a major part in helping us not only create the budget proposal, but also the policies.
Both the community colleges and workforce development office and the chancellor's office during this past interim have had work groups assigned to look at student success factors and where we need to have more focus in order to increase retention and completion of students wherever they're at in the system. And both groups have held extensive hearings and have looked a great deal at the research that exists not just in Oregon but across the country to better understand the dynamics and challenges that prevent students from starting on one of our campuses and then being able to prevail through to completion of whatever their particular goal is. They've heard from many different underrepresented populations, be they persons of different geography, rural, urban, different financial status, different racial or ethnic backgrounds, to understand all of the factors that affect a student's perception, first, of whether they belong on those campuses, and once they're there, how they assimilate with their colleagues and the faculty who teach them. And, you know, some very compelling testimony has been shared by people from all of the various interest groups. And I'm sure as you move into these budgets and the hearings from those two agencies, you'll hear some very strong pieces of information that help guide some of the why behind the earlier data about, you know, why do students step out and why do students fail to prevail to a degree. On the more upbeat side, this past biennium, the Senate Bill 334 created the Shared Responsibility Model revamp of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and in that bill was a requirement that there be a Shared Responsibility Model Steering Committee. That group has been meeting since adjournment to help shape for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission recommendations to the commission about how most effectively to implement that program. We've had a lot of different pieces of information to assess and to monitor, and some things, unfortunately, our crystal ball was not quite as clear as we would have hoped. We knew that all of you, as well as we in the governor's office, hoped to really make sure that Oregonians statewide were aware of this new opportunity, and a lot of effort was made by all of the sectors to get that word out, and I think we were quite successful at it, successful beyond our dreams and our budget, unfortunately. So the economy certainly also had a role to play in the challenges that we face with the program. Again, the steering committee is composed of people who have come from admissions and from the financial aid offices on all of our different types of campuses, and their expertise has really been very helpful in steering the decisions that needed to be made in a very quick and hopefully a fair manner.
And then the new diploma task force, Superintendent Castile and her staff at the Department of Education have been doing a great job working again with educators across the state to talk about what are the potential pitfalls, success points, things we can move more quickly on versus need more time, issues around how we implement this new diploma in such a way that we make sure Oregon students have a chance to succeed, not that we suddenly impose something on the students and, quite honestly, the teachers and staff in our schools, and knowing that we're setting them up for failure. So this task force has been helping to guide our office's thinking, and I know it has been guiding the superintendent and the state board as they have been looking at trying to move forward on the implementation. And then also the Veterans Education Services, Representative Roblin mentioned the military and the needs of our veterans, and as they come back from service overseas, as they serve in the Oregon National Guard, we want to make sure that the education system is designed to welcome them. And so we have a series of recommendations that we hope will provide access points for veterans as they look to our community colleges and universities and, again, help them not only enter
but navigate through, because they have been, for the most part, living in a world and a reality that is quite different from most of us, and we need to have people on the campuses that understand that and can help them move along. The final page in this segment, and then we'll open up for lots of questions, hopefully. You know, we have accomplishments that we should all be very proud of. We increased we had the school improvement funds that went out to schools. That has not only helped improve accountability, because the requirement is the school districts are reporting back to us not only how they planned to use the money, but the fact that they used it that way and what the results of that effort have been. It has helped districts focus on staff development, class size, the use of data, just providing staff members with an opportunity to sit down with their colleagues to talk about the data of their students and how that would impact the delivery of the education in that school or that classroom is vital, and these funds have helped to make that a reality. We have added, served over 3,000 additional students in the Head Start Oregon Pre-K program. Wonderful increase in funding with your support. Our community college enrollment, fall 2008 is a 12.2% increase over fall 2006. And while that is an aggregated number, we have several community colleges that are running again at 15-16% increases, and they are, as the economy has worsened, of course Oregonians are turning to our community colleges to look for the skill sets, the training that they need.
The last two bullets on this page speak to the increases that the Oregon University System has had. I think several of us are aware that some of our campuses even had housing shortages this last fall because of the overwhelming increase in interest in post-secondary education. But the system overall saw a 6.8% increase in fall 2008 above that of fall 2006. We think some of that is also attributable to the work that you did last session in creating the Oregon Opportunity Grant Shared Responsibility Model. In that program, this fall we served 11,000 students more than what we served a year ago in that program. That was 4,000 students above what had been expected at Sine Die at the end of the 2009 session. So with that, we'd like to take a break and answer some questions.
Thank you. I know Senator Hass has a question.
Thank you. I was intrigued by the question of which areas of policy leverage yields the greatest results, and I was just wondering your opinion on whether funding should be tied to those things. In other words, outcome-based measurement and funding.
Chair Gelser and Chair Hass, that is an excellent question, and you would have thought that we asked you to ask it, because, in fact, that is exactly what the work that we're trying to help develop, to provide not only the governor but all of you with a new set of tools whereby we can look at what our goal is and ask ourselves, the next dollar that we invest in the system, where should it go? Where are we going to get the greatest return, and also build the platform upon which the next investment would make sense? And as you've all heard the governor say repeatedly, that is why he has pushed so hard to make this a integrated education enterprise, so that we're not pitting sectors or grade levels or programs against each other, but we're really looking at the holistic picture and identifying where those key investments need to be across the continuum.
Thank you. And we've got a whole list of questions. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. The issue that I'd like to raise is probably a perception of many of our colleagues, and that has to do with, as I reflect on the data that you've presented, starting with the 2040-40 metrics and where we want to be and where specifically community colleges are today, And then looking at the enrollment data, K-12 has actually increased less than 1%. Oregon University System, 6.8%. And then community colleges, as you shared, dramatically increased. And then a reference, quote, to build a protective wall for education funding. And the point that I would make is, and I would express this on behalf of my community college, is they perceive that they've been left out of this system and how this, how we're going to elevate the system, but yet they've been denied in the governor's recommended budget. Could you shed a little light on how that all fits together?
Chair Yeltsin, Senator Morse, I appreciate that question. And let me give it to you in brief, because we're going to go into a little more detail in the next section, which is really looking at the budget proposal. But we hope that in this next section we're going to be able to demonstrate that, in fact, the governor was trying to treat the sectors comparably and raise the entire system. He is absolutely committed to our community colleges and knows what the vital role they play in. So we may have some differences of agreement as to how it played out, but they are clearly in his mind. And we are also hopeful that, and we can maybe have some more discussion around this a little later, that a number of the pieces that we are hearing from the President-elect Obama's transition team in the stimulus plan that they're looking at may have direct impact on providing additional funding to knowledge education, but to the community college specifically. So we can hopefully talk about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Representative David Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sager, Ms. Lau, as you know, last session I was a strong proponent of the new graduation requirements. Due to budget concerns several months ago, the governor signaled a retreat from implementing those new requirements. I'm curious to hear from either you or alternately Superintendent Castillo in terms of what we think we can do under the governor's recommended budget to move forward on those requirements.
Chair Yeltsin, Representative Edwards, again, thank you for that question, because it's one of those things we constantly are trying to clarify. The governor did not signal retreat. What he indicated to the Oregon School Boards Association was that he would ask the State Board of Education to look at the timeline and to find out if, in fact, the timeline is appropriate for the resources that in his budget he was going to be able to put forward, and especially in light of the fact that as all of you are aware of, even December 1st when he released his budget, he knew that the March and the June forecasts may be down further. Seeing that trend line coming, you know, again, not setting the system up for failure but actually success, but not retreating from the standards, not retreating from the ultimate goal, but maybe the timeline's a little different, and that's why the governor put in his proposal some resources for the department to continue their work, as well as school districts to continue the work. If you'd like, Superintendent, do you want to add anything?
Did you want me to still respond? Or?
If you have anything else to add, Superintendent.
We're all working together to continue the same progress. Expand on that later if you want me to.
Sure. I appreciate your diplomatic and concise response.
And now, this is not directed at the next person who's going to ask a question, but just as a time check, there are still two sections to go through. It's 3:24, and we have to be out of here absolutely no later than 5 o'clock. So please keep your questions concise, Senator Cruz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it very concise. Getting back to the veterans and obviously transitioning them back is important. My question is the training and the education they're getting while in the service counting towards a degree?
I will turn to Commissioner Boyce here in a moment. There are various programs that exist in the military, so it isn't a blanket across the board. Some, I believe it's the Air Force, actually has their own accredited community college system, and so there, you know, that's clean. Our community colleges have been working with the Army and other branches of the military to try and align the training programs and that the community college then requires, or the requirements that they have in their training programs to align those efforts. Because, again, nothing's worse than having served your country for several years, or received a great deal of training, demonstrated your knowledge and skill, maybe even under fire, and then come home and told, gee, you have to take some classes to prove that you know what you're doing.
Right. Madam Chair, I think that's important. That, I mean, we're looking for a seamless system, and that's another portion of education that we need to address. So.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James, I just went on the post-secondary quality education model. Where exactly are with that, and is there any discussion, if not, I'd like to push it, to do a pre-K quality education model as well for early intervention and for Head Start, and just then to see if they can all link together?
Chair Gelser, Representative Buckley. Let's start with the second part of your question first. That would be a very good idea. We've actually been working very closely, not only with the Department of Education, but also the Children's Institute and others that have been working on these issues around 0 to 5 years of age. And so while we don't have a commission per se yet, as you see in the governor's budget and his thinking, that is very important. He sees the value of it. And so hopefully we're going to be able to, if not a new commission, at least continue the collaborative work to continue to elevate the focus of that need. As far as the post-secondary quality work, as Margie mentioned, we are hoping that kind of the first prototype model will be available by the end of this month, where we can start looking at the indicators and making some decisions. It's ongoing work. We're hoping that just as the legislature endorsed and began to support the work of the K-12 commission, that you will do the same with the post-secondary commission, because the governor feels very strongly that their work is absolutely vital to the economic future of our state and aligning with, as I've said before, both the business needs and the prosperity that we all want. So we're moving ahead as fast as our poor volunteers can put in the time, and we can work with NGIMS and WICHE and other organizations to provide us some assistance.
Thank you.
And I would just add, Representative Buckley specifically mentioned the early intervention programs. I hope that as we move forward, we can elevate our importance and commitment to the early intervention and early childhood special ed program to at least match the commitment to Head Start. The needs of those students are extraordinarily important, both to their participation in K-12 schools and their ability to live independently as adults. So the trajectory of cost for the state is extraordinary. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation today. I think you've demonstrated with your charts about the various relationship of the various states on several specific questions that aggregate data doesn't provide very much useful information. That's my comment. My question is, it's constantly the case that we get aggregate data that in fact doesn't tell us very much about what we should do about anything, or even where we actually rank on anything that's meaningful. The question is this. On one of your later slides, the one based on real data, student flow model, based on real data, you talk about detailed data information. I'm wondering how detailed that gets. Are you able to get fine-grained enough so you can actually get down to track one student, or down to tracking a few students, or tracking students from a particular school or a particular cohort in a school? How fine-grained does that data actually get you? The reason I ask the question is because of my observation that aggregate data isn't very useful.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, the information that it goes into the model is at the individual student level. It's data that is required to be submitted by all of the post-secondary institutions to a national database called IPEDS. Don't ask me what that acronym is. I don't know it off the top. And that data is then the source of the information that allows us to compare ourselves to similar data with the other states. And the information that we'll have although we'll collect it by county so that we can have it in order to better understand the dynamics and issues that might be posed to students in a particular geography, it actually comes from that individual student progress throughout the system. And that's then complemented by the work that's going on in our knitting together the data systems that start from the point in which a student enters Oregon's educational system at whatever age or stage that might be, all the way through to their completion. They'll have a single student identifier, and the systems will be able to better understand the student's background. It's now being aided in terms of things like when students apply to go to college, they can then authorize their transcripts to be transmitted electronically from their high school to the institution of their choice for post-secondary education. So there's some things that are really there and tangible and helpful to the students as they progress. That information's then plugged into a database that higher education will use, both our community colleges as well as the Oregon University system, that will allow them to identify what courses count towards the completion of a particular major and where they still have gaps in terms of earning their diploma or certificate in that particular institution. And they can look at what other courses that are available that they might be able to take in the coming term or the coming year that will help them finish in a timely and hopefully cost-effective way.
Quick follow-up, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Very quick follow-up.
I think this is a yes or no. Could a social scientist who came along later and had access to this data get back to that individual student level to ask a different question than the ones that have already been asked or not? That's really that's a different way of asking the same question I tried to ask before.
Okay. Representative Barnhart, I turned to look to the colleagues here because we have some federal regulations.
I'm not talking about confidentiality. That's a different issue. I'm talking about whether you can get back at the data.
That's actually a part of an effort that's going on across the country. In fact, at a meeting.
So the answer is yes, I think.
Last month, it says yes, we will be able to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A hesitant, quick answer.
Senator Monroe?
Thank you. Two things. First of all, I'm a member of the Mount Hood Community College Board, and we were trying to figure out how to attract more returning veterans. And we found out that even though the federal government will pay for their education, they pay after completion of a successful completion of a term, and many of these veterans couldn't upfront the money, and so it stopped them from being able to enroll. Our community college decided to basically waive the first term's tuition so that then they could get started, be successful, and then get the federal money flowing. Would you suggest that other community colleges adopt a similar program?
Chair Gelser and Senator Monroe, I can't imagine that the answer would be anything other than yes.
Let's see if I do as well on my yes. Let's see if I do as well on my second question. Would you support changing the basic school support formula to pay a full FTE for those students that are enrolled in full-time kindergarten?
Chair Gelser and Senator Monroe, different question, different answer. The governor has been very interested in the issue of all-day kindergarten, just as we talked a few moments ago about early childhood education. He has worked with and spoken often with the superintendent behind me. The challenge that the governor recognizes right now, again, is that because of the economic environment we're in, if the funding formula were to be changed to pay for all-day kindergarten without having an appropriate increase in the pot of money going to schools, then those schools that have the ability to provide all-day kindergarten, they have the space and staff and whatever's needed, would be winners. And those districts that don't have that ability would actually be losers because they would lose some money for every other student that is in their system. So the governor hopes that we can make sure that this remains on kind of the front burner of talking about how we get to that point to be able to make that a reality, but recognizing that this is probably not the right time to ask the the system to absorb the cost of all-day kindergarten from the state school fund allocation, when in fact many schools and districts across the state will actually be economically harmed by that movement.
Well, a couple of follow-ups. First of all, one of the very poorest districts, the second poorest district in the state, David Douglas, provides all-day kindergarten and has to subsidize it out of other educational needs in that very, very poor district. Right. So it cuts both ways. And I was wondering whether or not something like a two-year lag to give districts knowledge and opportunity to get ready wouldn't be a better alternative than the gross misjudgment of educational policy allowing tuition to be charged.
Again, Chair Gelser, Senator Monroe, the governor is always open to discussion, again, how we can move towards, he has the same goal you do, same goal that the superintendent does and many others, to provide all-day kindergarten in the state of Oregon. The question is, how do we do it, and how do we, again, not have a negative impact on other districts and other students, but absolutely open to the conversation, see what we might be able to put together.
Senator Bonamici. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Barnhart did the great preface to my question for me. So with that in mind, I'd like to talk about the students who aren't completing high school currently. And as we move toward the zero goal by 2025, is it possible to ascertain from your data why the students are not completing high school? Can we get to the details of, is it socioeconomic? Is it curriculum? Is the curriculum too challenging, not challenging enough? How much detail can we get into on those numbers?
Chair Yeltsin and Senator Bonamici, the answer is yes to all those possibilities. Other issues that come up, and again, you've heard many of us talk about this before, we often talk about the rigor of the program, but the relevance of the program in the mind of the student. And so one of the issues that the governor has continued to advocate is for the, in some cases, restoration, other cases, the expansion of career technical education opportunities for students, because, again, they don't want to work in the theoretical, they want to work in reality and use their hands and help create. One of the issues we're going to talk about in the next section has to do with the new program that we're rolling out statewide, that if you look at the assessment that goes with this program, some of the data that we've been looking at shows us that students, and I'm talking about high school juniors and seniors, students that take the traditional college placement exams that do very well, do okay on the applied assessment, but not as well as those that didn't do as well on the traditional college admission test, but do very well in the applied. And so it begins to get you to realize that, you know, we all learn differently, we all apply our knowledge in a different way, so we have to expand the opportunities for students. So we not only need to have rigor in our program, but the relevance has to be there for students to see that this is actually leading towards their goal. Now, there are other issues, you know, when we have the unemployment rate growing and has been high for some time, there are family issues that come into play and many other things. The work that we're doing is trying to break down those subsets and identify, again, what are the things that we both in the short, medium, and long term can have a direct impact on to make life a little better for students of all ages and help them have a greater opportunity for success, that if they step up and put in the effort, that they'll reach the mark.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll try to keep this a long question with short answer that they can answer as they go on to the next part. And it really has to go back to...
And there's more questions after you.
Oh, that's good. Senator Morris's original question. And that has to do with, as I look at the preparation of budgets and I look at what's happened, it appears that the community colleges get treated much differently than the other parts of the system. And so that when you start with the essential budget level, their essential budget level starts out in a disadvantaged place, different from the others. And if it's supposed to be a system, you would think that that would all be the same. And I know the governor started the process, and it stopped before the session game, and so we got a second budget in which that disadvantage was entered into the budget process. Is there a way to get that so that we don't have that happen repeatedly, and so that we actually get to see a true essential budget level that is a comparable budget level to the other two groups, the higher ed and the K-12 system?
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin, the answer is yes, and we've been told by both LFO and BAM that they hope to have that model available mid to end of February.
Okay, because it is very frustrating mm-hmm. when I look at those numbers. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Sager, for that response. actually, thank you for this presentation. It's you know, it's great to see not only the model, but the snapshots that you've given us of where we are with respect to the model. Sometimes, though, snapshots just give us a very limited view, right? And sometimes we get, you know, caught in the trees as opposed to seeing the forest. It's useful to see just where we're trending in some of these areas. You know, for example, you mentioned that half of the students in the OUS system got there by way of the community college. Well, is that a number that's increasing? Is it a number that's decreasing? And I think we need to look at those trends to know really how to approach various issues. So I'm wondering, are you at a point where you could say with respect to 40-40-20, are we moving in the right direction? Are we not moving in the right direction? Are we stagnating? To give us some sort of longitudinal perspective.
I just mentioned something that just occurred that Margie got some additional information on that I'd like her to mention when I'm done answering your question. I guess the quick answer would be yes, we believe that the work that we're doing has not only indicated that we have been moving in the right direction as a state, but it has also opened our eyes to, again, some gaps in the system, which are really important for us to analyze, to find out, you know, why are these things occurring. It has also allowed us, and this is why the continued work of the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission is so important, we need to be able to have a group of smart people looking at this national data that comes out, this aggregate data, and ask ourselves, so what does this really mean for Oregon? And figure out what our trends are and what's occurring and how we can make investments. Because so oftentimes this data is several years old, and yet it comes out as if it is reflecting all the work that we've, you know, done for the last 6 months. It doesn't reflect the work we've done for the last several years. And we have a great example.
One of the reports that comes out that gets a considerable amount of national press is the report called Measuring Up. And this is a report where, particularly on the issue of affordability, all states except for California continue to receive a mark of F. And, you know, that smarted for us in the governor's office, and I'm sure it also didn't feel so good on the legislative side, given how much work everyone has put into this particular part of education for several years now. So when I met with the person who actually puts that report together, he puts the data together per the instructions that's given by his steering committee, I asked him, given that this data is all pulled from 2007, if we could plug in the appropriation amount that Oregon has put into the 2008-09 academic year, what would happen with Oregon's standing compared to the other 50 states? In the report that came out, we were actually, you know, of all of those that got an F, we were number 32 in rank. We would actually have improved our position to one of 21. So that added appropriation moved us 11 steps ahead of our peers across the country. That's one of those places where you know, it's hard for us to gauge because somebody has to collect all of the data from all 50 states. But, you know, it's another area where on graduation, the OUS system had the highest number of graduates they've ever had last year. The numbers are down for the current year. And they shared last session with the many of the committee the trend, and they can follow that the amount of how robust the funding is that supports the system has a great deal to do with our retention and completion rates. So something we all have to be more aware of.
Okay, Representative Lee, who gets the very last question.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to thank Margie for saying that, because when I was in elementary school and I came home and I had an F, and I tried to explain how it was actually one of the best Fs. So, thank you.
Chair Gelser, Representative Belizio, considering all 49 other states outside of California will probably always get an F under the methodology that is used, it probably is important to know we're 21st instead of 32nd. So,
thank you. Well, as we move on to the next section, knowing that we have two sections, I have an aspirational goal, which is 15 minutes for the presentation, 15 minutes for the questions. It's aspirational, but we only have a 15-minute cushion. So if you could do the next chunk in 15 minutes, that would be great.
Well, and Chair Galizio, we'll try to combine this into one section, and that way we can maybe have a longer period for question and answer. So now we would like to focus in on kind of what the governor was thinking of when he put together his budget and the policies behind that thinking. As Senator Monroe had commented and the governor mentioned in his State of the State message, he tried to build a protective wall around education funding. He recognizes that the future of Oregon, our ability to come out of this recession in a stronger position and being globally competitive, requires us to continue to invest in education. And now may be even more important time than ever to provide Oregonians with the skill sets they need. Just as an example, the governor has talked to hundreds of business owners, CEOs, and business leaders over the past several years. And you know, it is the rare exception that a business leader asks about the tax structure in the state. It is almost universal that they ask, what is your workforce like, and are you willing to put in what it takes to provide me the workforce that I need? The reason that the governor has been able to attract several companies in the past year or so is because he has made that commitment to them. We are going to, as a state, continue to step up and provide the workforce you need and the skill sets that you need. He also was very concerned about investing in areas to help students be successful. And again, as I've mentioned, we have to think differently about what is success. It is not simply a high school diploma or an AA degree or a four-year degree. There are all sorts of variations in between of what success is. And we need to make sure that we're providing Oregonians with those opportunities to have success. And then, of course, kind of building a contingency. The next slide begins to address the questions that I know both Senator Monroe and Senator Devlin have mentioned today. We have tried to illustrate here how the governor put his budget together around these four key parts of the education enterprise. And if you notice that under the 2009 column, thank you for under the 2009 column, this represents the actual appropriation number that is in the appropriations budget, or bill, coming out of the governor's budget. The second column is the withdrawal that the governor from day one is saying he wants all of us to be prepared to make a year from now out of the Education Stability Fund. So that what he did is he built the budget so that the programs for the 2009-2010 school year, in essence, would continue at the same program level they are now. And the withdrawal from the Education Stability Fund a year from now would be money that would then provide the necessary funds to make year two continue to be stable. His thinking behind this, a couple main points. If you think back to when the governor took office in the first 90 days, we lost $800 million in general fund money. And the governor looked around and discovered all of the pots of reserves and usable resources had been used. And so as we continued to roll further and further into this hole, we had already used all of the safety net. So he wanted to make sure that he doesn't leave for the next governor that same kind of problem. So his direction to those of us on staff was, think of using the Education Stability Fund starting year two of this biennia and out for the next 2 years so that we have a two biennia view of stability for education so that we don't have to retreat from the platform that we have built and that we can, as I've said before, be ready to move ahead as we come out of this recession. So if you look at some of these numbers, for instance, in community college, there is a $15 million amount that is identified as part of that withdrawal. That would then mean that the number is back up to the $500 million mark. So the $15 million that has been discussed as a cut, it is, if you look only at line or column one, it isn't if you look at column two. It also brings up the challenge, and so an expanded answer to Representative Roblin's question about essential budget level, by direction of this body, the legislature, to the Legislative Fiscal Office and the budget management people at Department of Administrative Services. Community colleges over the years have been viewed as a vendor because they are not a state agency. Therefore, the calculation has been, there's been this kind of simple percentage increase calculation that is applied, and we, in figuring essential budget level, don't capture enrollment growth, PERS, salary increases, anything else, but simply apply this inflationary factor. The governor, through executive order, directed a working group of BAM, LFO, and community college representatives to try and figure out a better way to put a new formula together. Even if that formula had been ready to present to you today, the governor couldn't have used that formula because it is by direction of this body that those formulas are put into the rules of how to build a budget. So even with that in mind, the governor did ignore some of the calculations because it would have meant a reduction, a further reduction in EBL using the old model. And he says, I know that's wrong. I may not know what the right number is, but I know that's wrong. And so he kind of had this hybrid approach to it. But we're all looking forward to having the new model created and thus it become part of the conversation to make sure that definitely for the next budget that's built that that is part of the formula. So in each of these categories, the governor has tried to restore in year two those funds that would appear to have been cut from each of the budgets to provide the support they need. We know today that the Opportunity Grant, if it continues to grow in demand, is going to need more than the $12 million we have earmarked currently. But in the governor's proposal, he used the number $225 million. We know that we could probably go up to about $250, $260 million and continue that three withdrawal approach to get out 4 years. With the later in this section of the presentation, when we talk about kind of where the future is heading, we all know that that may be, we may have to change some of our calculations, but at least you understand the logic that the governor went through to create this. So specifically, the governor has proposed an increase in our Oregon Pre-K Head Start program, It's not nearly as big of an increase as we had last time, but he thought it was important that we continue to make progress in meeting the needs of our Head Start students. And also that we, for the first time, begin to invest in the early Head Start program. So this is 0 to 3. And it's important for a couple of reasons. President-elect Obama indicated during the campaign that early Head Start and Head Start were very important to him. And so, and Oregon is the poster child in the country of the collaboration that we have between the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and Head Start. It's seamless. Parents and students don't know the difference. And this is unique in the country that we have this kind of program. We want to make sure that we create that in the early Head Start program, and thus we feel very good about the fact that we may be towards the front of the line when it comes to assistance that we get from the new administration in this effort, because again, we're going to be able to set the standard. The third area in early learning, as we've identified here, about a 12.1% increase in early intervention services and an 18.5% increase in regional disability and autism services. So again, while Chair Galizo, you're absolutely right on, we need to continue to look at this and continue investments. I'm sorry, Gelser.
We had more.
It's that G that gets it.
Yeah, we had more money last time. It was a lot more.
Maybe that was it. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
It's an honor.
I'm glad you think it's an honor. I'm embarrassed. But we need to continue to focus on that. In K-12, as I mentioned, the governor is very concerned about implementing the new high school diploma. And so what resources he put into the department to continue their work, because the department needs to help pull a lot of information together to help districts as they make preparations. He put specific resources into career technical education, tying that investment at the community college level, but requiring that those programs also be tied back to the high schools in their region and be tied to the economic priorities that the governor established for the state. A third area is professional development planning. A message we have received across the state is that, and was articulated actually in the Quality Ed Commission model, says that school districts and staff members need time to plan and do the work that's necessary to prepare for the new high school diploma requirements. And so it is important that not only do school districts kind of focus their resources there, but administrators and superintendents across state said, we need some place to go to in order to find out what are good programs going on out there. What's my neighboring district doing? And so a proposal that will be coming forward will set up a statewide website where we'll be able to offer that that information, and also build upon the work that kind of an ad hoc group has been doing, a partnership between the department and our ESDs both K-12 and the post-secondary system, to develop ways of looking at key professional development needs that are across the state and making sure that we can provide that all across the state, that it's not just dependent on having to be a large district or one that happens to have a key resource. And also then the continued work on the mentor program. Again, this is one of those that is a little confusing because of the way the dollars were split, but in that second year withdrawal, there is money in there for part of the second year continuation of the mentoring program. And so it was the only way that the governor could balance the budget. But all those remain very important. A program that I'm sure all the various committees that are here as well as others will receive presentations on during the session and is really a cornerstone for the governor has been the development of the Oregon Career Readiness Certificate. And I compliment Commissioner Preuss and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and everyone else that has helped put this together. It is a system whereby people of all ages. I don't care if you're 16 or 66. You can take an assessment and be able to walk out with an industry-recognized certificate demonstrating the level of skill set that you have. And these assessments and the rating on these assessments have been aligned to thousands of jobs, not only across the country, but clearly here in the state of Oregon. Yep. And so it is a way that not only will our high school students be able to help demonstrate that they have met the essential skills and that upon graduation they are clearly ready to enter the workforce, but our adult workforce, who, as we know, it has some... they don't have maybe the academic credentials behind them, will have a way of being able to demonstrate that they have the skills also necessary and be able to go to employers. This has been extremely well received by the business community in Oregon. The demand is much heavier than what we're able to meet at the present time, but those businesses that have utilized the system and their different degrees of how they can utilize it. But just as an example, we had one local Oregon company. They had, I believe it was like 8 openings. They had several hundred people apply. All of the applicants were put through initial testing, so they were able to kind of sort down. The end result was the people that they interviewed, they said, was the best group of potential employees that they had ever interviewed. And they were absolutely thrilled with the people that they hired. So it really helps make a much stronger connection between Oregonians individually, of the business community, and ties right back to the whole education enterprise and the work we're doing. And I probably haven't done it justice, but it's just a fascinating project. The other item to highlight here are the targeted funds, and again, this ties to the career technical education programs that we're focused on the community colleges and how we're trying to focus the federal dollars that are coming in around workforce. And the four areas of focus are manufacturing, green, clean technology, healthcare, and what we define as regional high-wage, high-demand occupations. And that's important because, again, historically, people in rural parts of the state were often rightly upset or confused that, well, gee, we show these lists of high-wage, high-demand jobs, but none of them appear in anywhere close to where I live. And so the great work of the Employment Department to drill down on this data and now be able to create it in every county and community in the state of Oregon is going to be very helpful in us making those connections. So an investment there.
To shift gears a little bit, post-secondary access is something that we've talked about a couple of times already in the presentation. The shared responsibility model is a cornerstone for that effort, and we have a very important phase in, because in the current biennium's budget, we've only paid for the operation of the shared responsibility in 1 year. And so the numbers are a 50% increase. That 50% is because we need to pay for both years next biennium. We've focused the resources that we've put into post-secondary education around maintaining course offerings so that when students do pursue advanced education, there's an adequate number of courses and classes available for them to achieve their objectives. We also have tried to engage in programs of both the career technical education as well as some of the programs within OUS to better suit the returning student, not just that student who stepped out a year, but maybe the student who stepped out 5 or 10 years, so that the system is going to be one that they can be also successful in. We've already mentioned the veteran services programs. Adopting a process where we're going to have veteran services officers on community college and Oregon University campuses, so there's people there who understand the veterans' needs and their benefits, who can better translate that to the rest of the academic community and make sure that it's a successful process for everyone. There's a new GI Bill that's got some wonderful benefits for those folks who are coming home, and we want to make sure that those resources are deployed to the maximum benefit of Oregonians. We look at tuition issues, both as they relate to the shared responsibility model and to what our expectations are on campuses. We want to continue to tie that to the median family income so that we maintain affordability. In the Oregon University system, in addition to the retention efforts and better serving previously underrepresented populations, we've also got $3 million that we've identified for continued work on the engineering technology investments that have been made over the last decade. We're making good headway, but we're still many, many miles away from our doubling the number of engineers that the state embarked on that course more than a decade ago. So we've got to continue that effort. And we also include in the OUS budget the proposal that will allow them to retain their interest earnings on student tuition and fee dollars that are paid, and hope that legislation that the Oregon University system is asking will receive a positive response from your colleagues. Then in terms of capital construction, I think we're all aware that capital construction not only makes sure that we have modern and appropriate facilities for our students, but in putting them up, it provides jobs for people all across this state. And this budget that the governor is asking you to approve is very aggressive from both the student benefit as well as the Oregon workforce benefit. There are a number of these proposals that are financed with many different types of tools. Some of them are dollars that are solely based on fees on the campuses, and some of them are ones that use lottery funds as well as state general fund. And then in addition to that, we have three projects with the community colleges. So.
And just again to highlight the connection that this partnership goes beyond the education sectors, but also includes the Employment Department, BOLI, the OECDD, and others to really align with the strategic cluster investments as well as the workforce initiatives that we've talked about to make sure that these align on the workforce side, the research side, and the academic program side. And so that we kind of combine these last two, I think if we look at the next slide. We get to hit the button. That was my fault. I'm sorry. We really think that we need to recognize that we're going to have to talk about the revenue forecasts, where we think they're going to be, the impact of the allotment reduction that the governor was followed under the statutory restrictions. And so with that, what I would suggest is that we open up to question and answer, and except for a few minutes of closing comments, we could have this be the last section.
Thank you. I'm confident that there are questions. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It appears there's a high probability that in the federal stimulus plan there will be some monies coming to the states, presumably in a block grant, hopefully in that category. Has the governor's office, has the governor settled on the priorities for where those monies would be applied in the context of capital construction and some of the maintenance things that we have on the table?
Chair Gelser and Senator Morris, the governor hasn't settled on specific projects yet because we don't know for sure how the package is going to come together. It seems to be changing almost by the hour. He does believe very strongly that there will be a portion of funds that could very well help the operations side of education, but also the
deferred maintenance, capital construction needs. He was at a press conference this morning in Portland making it clear that he supports having those resources go to all three sectors, community college, universities, and K-12. And so what he is prepared to do is as soon as we get some clear messages from Washington as to what the component pieces are, that he will pull key people from all three sectors to help us. We have some prioritized lists inside each sector, but then we, again, want to make sure what kind of constraints there might be on it. He's also very concerned that we make sure we spread the opportunity across the state so every community in Oregon benefits from the stimulus package, and so we'll pull all the key people together and prioritize across sectors at that time.
Thank you.
More questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you. James, I got a couple questions. First of all, the governor's budget, and you mentioned the accomplishments of 07, 08, and you mentioned specifically the School Improvement Fund. I chaired that committee that created that in 2006, but the governor doesn't have it. He's just taken the money and put it into the formula, and that's a whole different issue. Representative Roble and I were talking about some concerns about how some school districts use that, but that is not part of the basic school fund from this last session, and so I have a comment about why this is viewed as an accomplishment, and then it's totally abandoned. The second thing, question is, just looking forward on the budget issue. I think everybody at the dais here and in the room and listening has that feeling in the gut that things are going to get a lot worse than the numbers that have been allocated here. When we get the forecasts as we go forward, certainly on a national level, a global level, people are very uncertain as to how long this downturn is going to last because it's driven by different factors than we have seen for decades. So when we get to those decisions and we have a little clearer picture of what the revenue for the state is, and we look at trying to preserve our students, our advances, what approach and what maybe willingness of the governor and those of us in the legislature, those of us as Superintendent Castile, is to look at how do we ensure, regardless of what that number turns out to be, that we preserve the delivery of the to the students at the end, rather than what has been a very difficult political issue, but that is we preserve the integrity of and the cost of the delivery system, and we assume as a fixed cost, primarily personnel costs, and if we don't have the money, then the students will suffer lack of days, lack of instruction. And I realize, and the governor had made this clear in his first term, that he doesn't control almost 200 school districts. But we all have leadership in that issue. Are we going to hold the children harmless, or are we going to hold the system harmless if, in fact, our downturn turns out to be worse than we anticipate?
Chair Yeltsin, Senator Metzger, good questions. Let me first deal with the School Improvement Fund and how that came about. 6 months ago, when the picture was much brighter and we were working on kind of the first drafts with the governor, his thinking at that time, and he had mentioned this in previous years, was that we would need each biennia to roll the School Improvement Fund money into the base so that we deliver the clear message to the education community that you just started some new programs that we know are good and it takes a long period of time to see all the results. We're not going to pull that money out from under you. It needs to now be in the base. And then you create another school improvement fund. And quite directly, the governor's sense was that the new school improvement fund would be targeted to what is needed for the high school diploma. The Quality Education Commission called for about $260 million in that effort, and that was the target that he had to put into the new school improvement fund. Quite honestly, really my error, and so I'm absolutely willing to admit it, that as we were going through the budget cuts and getting down to what would balance with the November revenue forecast, we kind of lost sight of that rolling, and the School Improvement Fund disappeared. I had forgotten that we have, I believe it's 5 school districts in the state that don't receive additional state funds, but they did receive funding from the school improvement fund, so we have to fix that. And because the legislation that created the school improvement fund had reporting requirements, that needs to be addressed. So again, with our analyst in budget management and LFO, they've been working on what it would take to separate those two pieces. But it also raises, and so the governor wouldn't be opposed to that at all, to kind of keep that, since we're not creating a new one, continue to highlight the fact that we have one. But it also raises, you've raised the question of how do we kind of hold students or the system, school, something harmless, community colleges and universities harmless during this time. The governor tried his very best to build this protective wall. And in that, you have to think about it from the standpoint of the priorities that he set. The reality is, if we lose another $300, $400, $800 million, you know, you name the number, education's a little over half of the budget. And the governor has already had to anguish over the cuts he had proposed in the DHS budget. So it is going to be very tough to grapple with it and to say that to what degree we're going to be able to hold things harmless. But the priorities are there as we think about the possibility of having to ratchet down the total budget. It also raises the question about, do we have state mandates? For instance, the reporting requirements in the school improvement fund. Should those requirements be suspended for a period of time? If, in fact, school districts can indicate to us that it costs an amount of money that could be directed to saving programs. So we're going to need to explore all of those avenues with community colleges and universities also as to how we can make sure that we're getting every dollar possible into the programs that are going to benefit students. I'm not here today to imply at all that this is going to be easy. It's going to be very tough because even developing the budget that the governor did had to make some very tough decisions, even inside education, as to what we just simply could not do for this coming biennium.
Can I have a follow-up, Representative?
I thought you might, yes.
Gelser, let me be more specific about that question.
Sure.
And you and I once served on a financial board together, and we had to make some tough decisions in order to make sure that the customers got their services.
Yep.
When I'm just asking specifically, and I think we have seen this in Detroit, in which everybody has to have skin in the game in order to deliver the product that we want. We want to make sure that our students in K-12, pre-K, community colleges, and higher ed get the best education possible and maintain this track that we're wanting to do. We can't control all the dollars that come in. But if we set that as our top priority, then in extraordinary circumstances, we can take the step of asking everybody who helps deliver those services to put some skin in the game in order that at the end result, the students do not suffer. If, in fact, these numbers continue to decline, you know, is the governor, and again, as I said, all of us, you know, willing to ask that everybody put a little skin in the game rather than simply stop the services or reduce the services to the students of the state?
Chair Gelser, Senator Metzger, the answer is yes. In fact, he's already started those conversations. You saw in his budget proposal as it would impact state employees. But as you indicate, we don't have direct control over either community colleges or the K-12 system. And he has already communicated with unions and management alike that they need to be taking similar approaches to dealing with the cost drivers. Now, he has said that recognizing if you go back to the 2001-03 recession time, the state is able to kind of react to it quite quickly because at the beginning of each biennium, basically, we have negotiated with state employees. The school districts and the community colleges, because they have rolling contracts, if you look at the trend, it took them longer to get down to
no increases or even in some cases decreases, and then it took them a longer period of time to come out of that hole. The state was able to say there's a salary freeze, and you know, 2 years later provide some relief from that. The community college in K-12 go in slower, come out slower because of the rotation of their collective bargaining agreements. So, as I said, the governor has already started that communication with management and labor. He feels very strongly that both will respond appropriately as they have in the past, and that hopefully we don't have to. Hopefully, it doesn't go too deep, so that we may run out of options on that. In that line of thinking, but clearly it's one that all of us have been willing to talk about.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to talk a little bit about the federal stimulus prospects. You mentioned the importance of having geographic diversity and spreading it across the three educational sectors. But I think there's going to be a very high priority on projects that are ready to go tomorrow. And I think probably that's more in the higher education area, at least from what I've heard. But my question is, who are you working with at the federal level to make sure that you're trued up with what's likely to be expected? Because this could, you know, the stimulus, the federal stimulus program, if we are right at the front of the line in being very prepared to start immediately, we could have a real economic benefit from the stimulus program, let alone our education system. So I guess what I'm looking for is a sense of priorities within your office. I mean, I looked at a list recently of deferred maintenance things. Well, they're not geographically spread, because if you go with the ones that are ready to go now, it doesn't happen that neatly. And it doesn't happen that neatly that it goes across all three sectors necessarily. And yet, if your objective is to get as much stimulation into our economy as possible, I guess what I'm looking to hear is that that's a top priority, and I'd like to know who you're working with directly in Washington to make sure that we're trued up with the latest developments on that program.
Chair Gelser, Senator Burdick, we are in constant communication with our federal delegation and have a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. that is walking the halls on a regular basis and calling us almost daily with updates. And it is really a moving target right now, but some of the things that we do feel fairly comfortable about. One is that many of these pieces appear will come to us in block grants. I think, Senator Monroe, you mentioned it. And that the federal government will be using current federal program delivery systems to get those dollars out to the state, so they're not going to be creating a new bureaucracy to try and handle this. On the deferred maintenance issue, we have been working with the Oregon School Boards Association and others to gather data from our 198 school districts. So if you kind of lay out school districts, community colleges, universities, their satellite campuses, et cetera, you do get a good statewide spread of opportunity for programs. And a lot of these programs may appear to be, or projects may appear to be very small, but in a small community could have a great impact. And so that's what the governor is looking at. That's what we understand the transition team has been looking at, and Congress has been looking at, that basically the rule has been, can you be shovel-ready within 100 days? For school districts especially, it means kind of after the close of the school year, because you don't want to be digging holes or fixing roofs while the kids are in school. And so we've been gathering that list. I have to compliment the leadership in all the sectors, because not only have they been very responsive, both in providing us a list, but also very honest in saying, you know, we don't have any that are going to be ready that soon, but we could have things ready in 9 months or 12 months. And so you begin to lay out a longer-term view of how the stimulus could be spread out so that it isn't just a one-shot kind of wonder during 90 days, but in fact builds over time. Because many indications from Washington, D.C. is that the stimulus package may come out in pieces and not all at one time. So we have the lists. We're continuing to develop them. We're ready to prioritize those lists across the sectors. We're working with our delegation, who are all in very good position to help craft the final package. And we have had regular and ongoing communication with the transition team. So we believe we're in pretty good shape.
Thank you. Representative Galizia.
Oh, didn't indicate that I...
Oh, I can, you did.
But I've got stuff to say. Not all about
that's
my
really,
F in elementary school.
Really
I've got some
to get
other
this
things.
Moving quicker, aren't you?
Maybe you're reading my mind. So, first, talking about the federal government, show me the money. I mean, you're supposed to say cautiously optimistic. I guess being cautious. I don't know what's going to happen at the federal, and I'm sort of working with the idea that we have limited control, and what are we going to do? So until I see exactly what we're getting, I'm going to assume that we're not getting much of anything. But having said that, Senator Metzger said that we don't control the money that comes in, and I agree, we don't. But we do. Have an influence on the money that comes in, and that's something that we're all going to be grappling with this session, surely. In terms of skin in the game, aren't you glad you called on me? skin in the game, I mean, there's been a lot of skin lost over the years, and certainly in the in 01 and 03, where things were very difficult. I think that's when Doonesbury made Oregon very infamous. Mm-hmm. That kind of symbolism obviously hurts us to a degree we can't really measure in terms of businesses wanting to come to Oregon and people wanting to move here. And it's been kind of a strength. Oregon is seen as a place that people want to live. So although we don't know what the budgets are going to be, education, it's no longer, especially higher education, it's no longer a luxury. I think a lot of people in our generation and older, it's been seen as something of a luxury, but higher education is now a necessity for us to be competitive. Students understand that. What I'm reading, and I know Chair Gelser, he said turn off your BlackBerry, but I had it on. And what I'm reading is that there are 2,700 students who wanted to tap into the shared responsibility model because they want to go to institutions of higher education in this state, and they were denied that. I'm not saying that's our fault, but I think OSU President Rabe really put it very succinctly the other day when he said, we're in danger of creating a permanent underclass in Oregon when we look at generationally. So I don't know what's going to happen. None of us do. But I just think what we cannot do is look at higher ed as a luxury, and we have to prioritize that. And not, I don't mean, forgetting other sectors, but we just tend to look at higher ed first for places we can cut, and then that increases tuition, and that's a cycle that's really dangerous, so I hope we can avoid that. I do have one question. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just going to get these things on the record. I'd say in the last 5 or 10 years, and community colleges especially, talk about education as kind of a private good. Say, if you get a BA or an AA, or if you get a degree, you're going to earn X amount of dollars over your lifetime. And I don't know that. Do you think we've done a very good job of talking about education, and especially higher ed, as a public good? And is that a problem in terms of, as we move forward and we try to create a culture where education is valued more highly?
Chair Gelser, Representative Galizio. The governor has been trying to help deliver that message for 6 years now, that it is in the public good.
But what he discovered early on, and I think we have to keep in our minds, is that for whatever reason, the impression that the general public in Oregon has is that when you start talking about college, it starts going past them, because their image is of the, again, the kind of traditional, you know, okay, I have to have a four-year degree. The message we have delivered for the past two decades in this country is you're really of no value to us unless you have a four-year degree. And he has been trying to help people get back to expanded vision of what it means beyond high school, that post-secondary education and training beyond high school. If you look at the data from the Employment Department, 80% of the jobs projected to be open and available in Oregon over the next 10 years require training and education beyond high school. They do not require a four-year degree. Several do. And over time, to move up professionally, you may have to pursue that. But that initial entry point doesn't. And so that message to, again, not only the traditional pipeline of students coming through K-12, but the adult workforce has to be, there are opportunities out there, and we have an education and training system that is open and available to you to get the training and education you need to qualify for the jobs that are here in Oregon, the jobs that are in your community. And that's why this alignment work is so important. That then becomes the community good. Your local community is going to benefit because you happen to take two classes at the community college, which made your business more successful and able to stay in business. I mean, those are the kinds of connections that the governor has been trying to deliver, and I know you and others have been trying, and we just need to keep hammering that that image.
Thank you. Senator Devlin, were you in the queue, or is that another
thank you, Madam Chair.
Signal?
you're being very telepathic today. I don't want this to come out wrong. A statement and then a couple questions, actually. I always think language is important, and don't tell anybody, particularly not my public affairs director in the caucus or the president's public affairs, but I hate PR. This term, held harmless, I hate that term, because I don't think any of the community colleges feel that they've been held harmless. I can guarantee you that of the whatever number you're going to give, 199 or 198 school districts, they don't believe they've been held harmless. The students who we turn down in terms of shared responsibility model because we ran out don't believe that they were held harmless. I would give the governor a lot of credit, and you and others a lot of credit, for minimizing the harm to education, but I hate the term held harmless because I think it gives a lot of people a misimpression that is actually probably doing more damage than good. Then to the question. You put it up here in a sense, and the reality of this, it's almost like deja vu, is 2001, by the time we finished 2001, take the state school fund. The last $800 million of that school fund was some all different kinds of funny money. It was reduced, but then the last about $700-800 million was all kinds of funny money. It was one-time money. It was money we moved from other wares. And then we had this really weird thing where we were going to allow school districts to basically accrue a future payment so that they stayed solvent. And one of the things in the governor's budget that troubles me is this, in a sense, promise out there of the Education Stability Fund, which most of us know may not be there by that time. So, I mean, I think people need to realize that that may not be there. The question I have is, because you go back that far.
Yes.
We sold, remember, we sent out two pieces of legislation, two referrals to Oregon voters for an education stability fund. They rejected the first one. But we sold it to them as an education stability fund. We knew what had happened in that biennium. How deep do you think the governor's and your view is of that as what it actually was set up for, is to be an education stability fund. I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question, I know, but I think people need to understand the history of why it was put in place.
Chair Gelser, Senator Devlin, first of all, on the use of the word held harmless, I hear you, and I know our communication staff is monitoring this hearing today, so they're probably taking note. Yes, you're right. I mean, the accrual accounting tricks, or cruel accounting tricks, that we used in the past, many of our community colleges and school districts are still living under that problem and continue to find it a problem. The governor is not real interested in those kinds of trade-offs. The Education Stability Fund, you have to remember that on December 1st, when the governor put out his budget, it was based upon the November revenue forecast. Having that as your context, the logic that the governor had in his proposal makes absolute sense. He wants to make sure the Education Stability Fund is there for education and that it provides stability over 4 years, and that we don't dip into it so quickly that next year it's already gone. Or as the forecast continues to drop, we have kind of rebuilt and we go through these special sessions like we did before, where we rebuild and then have a loss, and we come back and rebuild again and have a loss. So that was the framework that the governor set out. Now, as you look at the new revenue forecast, we may have to adjust those calculations, but the Education Stability Fund needs to be used to provide as much stability to education over the period of time that we're projecting we're going to need assistance because of the recession, that it possibly can. The worst thing that could happen would be for us to withdraw the money, say, even if I know we can't, but let's assume that we could withdraw the money July 1, and we make a wonderful 09-11 budget, and we put new money into education, because we project there's going to be about $600 million there. Well, that's great, because come September, when the revenue forecast drops further, now we're going to have to come back and resort again. That's what the governor's trying to avoid as much as possible. A, look out to use the stability fund at a point where we see that, in fact, it can help provide continuity. Don't dip into it so soon that we use it all up, and now we have nothing to make adjustments, so we have actually a bigger hold to deal with as far as cuts, and set it up so that the dollars only go to support education. Use the rainy day fund to support other sectors of the budget. Did that answer your question, sir?
That answered the question. The concern I have, and I think many of the members around here have this concern, is we all know we're going to have a forecast in, well, the March will come out in February, probably late February now. It's deja vu again, because it's like the 03 session, which the one of the things we do around March is to balance the existing biennium we are in. If that drops down too far, now the governor has done the reasonably prudent thing and proceeded with the allotment process, but if it drops down too far, you're going to be in the red, and you can't be in the red. And then you don't have enough time left to cut, which is the same situation we were in 2003. The cuts that you can make are minimal.
Right.
Even though I hate to say it, the prudent thing would be to go to the rainy day fund, maybe not the Education Stability Fund, not to borrow the money like we had to last time, to stay solvent. I mean, it's not a preferable thing, but it doesn't make sense to go out and borrow the money to stay solvent when you do have a rainy day fund. So that's more of a statement.
If I could, Chair Gelser, I mean, this is why, and I'll come back to your comment, Representative Galluzzo. The governor does believe that the federal government will come through with stimulus. I've been talking too long. Stimulus plan. What is another message that he is delivering is it needs to be soon, because just as you commented, Senator Devlin, if it's too far down the path, it doesn't help us because we've already gone through the cut process. But in fact, the indications that we have currently, if that plan is put together by latter part of February, which is what they're now telling us will happen, and depending upon how retroactive it is or not, we have the potential to have enough. The Oregon portion would be large enough to have a significant impact on helping us get out of this current biennia, as well as then allowing us to look over the next two biennia, how we would use our reserve funds in a very prudent manner.
Thank you. Representative Maurer, I know you need to go.
Yeah. Mr. Sager, question about the request from districts for stimulus, however that's going to be packaged. As late as last Friday, I'm not convinced that all the districts have been contacted, and that I know districts in my area are preparing lists, but there has been some confusion. There's some nonprofit out there that's soliciting a list. Districts were left off, including both in my district. That is a serious concern, and so I just need to be reassured that, in fact, this is going to be a fair process, and we're not going to cherry-pick districts. And I'm not blaming you at all. This was the nonprofits issue, but it is going to be a fair process.
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, yes, the governor absolutely wants to make it a fair process. We know that all districts have not responded. We've been working through directly with the Oregon School Boards Association. They put out a request to all districts through a SurveyMonkey or some process, but we know that isn't always successful. So we're not going to simply take the feedback we got a couple weeks ago and say that that's it. We're going to continue to reach out and make sure we get responses from all districts, whether it's again, continuing to work with OSBA, the department, our ESDs, whatever it takes to make sure that we've gotten the information we need before decisions are made.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
Thank you. We all know that since the passage of Measure 5 and then 47 and 50, that there's relative equality in funding per pupil across this state. Not exact, but relative equality. But not in the area of capital. In capital need, there's great disparity. There's tremendous differences in wealth as identified by assessed value per pupil from one district to another. Sometimes more than a tenfold difference, which means that some districts that are poor and high growth find it almost impossible to pass a bond because it puts an overwhelming burden on each homeowner versus a wealthy district where there's a relatively minimal burden on each particular individual homeowner. I would hope, you know that's true, I would hope that in any allocation of capital money, you take that into consideration. Where the need is and where the ability to pay is, district to district. Now, it's also true with community college districts. There are relatively poor community college districts and relatively rich community college districts. Relatively poor community college districts have had an awful hard time passing bonds, badly needed. So I would hope that you would take those things into consideration. I hope someday we will find a structural fix to the great disparity in capital wealth from one district to another. But in the meantime, if there are dollars that come from the federal government, I would hope that you would consider that when you allocate those dollars.
Chair Gelser, Senator Monroe, absolutely. I mean, those are all very good points, and that's why the governor is committed to bringing the key players together. Because when you sit down and you talk about these various needs, it really probably does. It will,
My guess is it will not require a mandate either from the governor or from the legislature that some of these issues be taken into consideration. The people that work in our community colleges, universities, and schools districts across the state are well aware of the needs of communities around them, and I think that they have repeatedly shown that their ability to reach out and help each other and recognize those differences. And it because of the impact of Measure 5 and 4750, it has created an even greater disparity because in Oregon, we cannot use 11G bonds, which is the bonds that we use for community colleges and universities, to provide assistance to our K-12 districts. At the same time, we have to recognize that even if we could, we still have a debt limit that the governor's proposal pushes us towards that debt limit because he's absolutely committed. The only way to pull us out of a recession is to put people to work, and this is the way we can do it. So there's going to be balance. We'll try to take into account all the variables that we possibly can, and that there is, as we've said before, distribution across the state.
Right. And I think we have two more questions. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I would like to kind of follow up on Senator Metzger's final question, and I would like to focus, instead of on skin, on mandates. Now, I have to tell you that if I talk to my superintendents, every one of them to a superintendent says the mandates are killing them. And I got to tell you that the Republicans are going to put mandates on education, and the Democrats are great at putting mandates on education. If there's any cost savings, I would like to know what mandates that we could remove at the state level to reduce costs.
Chair Gelser, Senator Girard, there's actually a work group that has been working on just that question. The Department of Ed and COSA and OSBA and others have been pulling together a list of those mandates and getting feedback from school districts as to whether or not a suspension or elimination of that mandate would save money and how much and how it could be used. So absolutely we're working on that angle as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
I guess I should declare a conflict of bias. Yeah. I was a Head Start director for 22 years, and I actually was one of the people that got to write the legislation that created the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program in 1987. So I'm very encouraged to hear you talk about the fact that the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program has adopted the federal performance standards, and they are seamless. And as a Head Start director that operated in two states, I can tell you there is a remarkable difference in trying to operate with a state program that's poorly funded, underfunded, not quite the same standards with one that we had in Oregon. So I'm pleased to have you say that, and I think that's one of the beauties of this Head Start program. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to say a few final comments?
Well, we just lost our slide. That's okay. The final slide in your packet kind of reiterates the mission, the 40-40-20 goals, and the outcomes. We had a State Board of Higher Ed retreat last week, And I can't remember, I believe it was the outgoing director, Don Blair, who made the comment to us, and it really struck home with me, that we're not creating a system for today. We're not creating a system for ourselves, maybe not even our children. What we're creating is a system for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. And that really helps, I think, all of us to get into perspective again, this idea that, and again, you've heard the governor say this often, while it is important what we do for the next 2 years, it is important that what we do for the next 2 years puts us on the right path for the next 20 years. That we have to be thinking out to 2025, where do we want to be, and thus be able to make those incremental steps towards that goal, even in tough financial times. And so we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with all of you. We look forward to working with you during the session, and hopefully even with the
tough economic times, we'll be able to come out in hopefully June with a good, solid message and budget and set of policies for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, everyone, for coming today and participating in an over 30-person discussion, and we are adjourned.
Very nice.
Very well. Very, very good.